Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, I'm David Kern.
I'm Heidi White.
And I'm Tim McIntosh.
And you are listening to Close Reads, a podcast for the incurable reader. And we're here to discuss Daphne du Maurier's novel, Rebecca. We're here to discuss chapters 8 through 14 of this very gothic novel. Is this the gothiciest of gothic novels, or is it like mid-second tier gothiciest? Can I just say gothiest?
A Heidi question.
Because gothiest is easier to say than gothiciest. Gothiciest sounds like a disease you get in a desert.
Mm. One that you don't want.
Or on a windswept moor.
I was going to say, you got to be on the moors to catch the gothiciest.
Let's just use gothiest.
Gothiest.
Heidi, is this the gothiest
what
book
tier
of the gothy books that you've read?
What tier of gothy books of gothic books?
I think it's in the top tier, but it's not the gothiest.
Okay. What's the gothiest?
I think it's Wuthering Heights.
Oh.
Well, it's
I've
called
never read Wuthering Heights.
So it's about Wuthering on Heights.
And I'm like crazy about Wuthering Heights. And I know that's like a weirdo thing. There's always always controversy about this particular novel. Most people I know like hate that novel. I love Wuthering Heights. So if there's like a continuum of gothic, you may push me right over the edge and I will fall into the abyss being like, I loved that book.
You'll be at the highest peak of the old mansion.
I'm all about it. The most melodramatic, twisted love that takes place in the darkest part of the night in the weirdest old medieval castle. I'm totally for it.
Okay. So this is like maybe top level, but like somewhere below Wuthering Heights. And well, we're going to read Jane Eyre next so we can talk about that.
Yes.
Is this
ranking it according to greatness.
No.
Gothiest. Was gothiest.
Right. We understand.
Yeah. Well, I just want to make sure our listeners understand. So,
wise to clarify before they come after you. It's right.
Right.
So, we are here, as I said, to discuss chapters 8 through 14 of this top tier gothic novel, and at least in terms of its gothic qualities. Before we do that, though, I want to remind you about a new series of books that B&H Publishing is releasing. It's Karen Swallow Pryor's series of editions on classic works of literature. So bringing the best of the classics, we have
are you getting emotional about this? Yeah. This ad?
It's very special.
He's feeling gothy.
I started trying to say something and then realized that if I kept going, it was going to be like air bubbles or something. I don't know. Who knows what was going to come out? I knew it wasn't going to be words though. So I had to pause. And we could take this out. I mean, I know Logan's not going to take this out, but in another podcast, we would take this out. But let me start that over again. Bringing the best of the classics, award-winning English professor and author Karen Swallow Pryor, friend of the show, provides insightful introductions and reading tips that help you read through the lens of the gospel. So the series includes Jane Eyre, which is the book we're going to talk about next. That one's coming out this March. Frankenstein, we talked with her about that last year. Heart of Darkness and Sense and Sensibility, with more coming next year. You could pick up these beautifully designed classics today, and you can reread these literary masterpieces with a faithful guide who has spent a lot of time studying them. If you would like to learn more about this series, you can head over to bhpublishinggroup.com/classics. So that's bhpublishinggroup.com/classics. And we are very much looking forward to talking about Jane Eyre with Karen on our very next book here on the podcast. And we're going to be using her edition. Now, you can use whatever edition you want, but here on the show, we are going to use her edition. I believe it releases March 9th. You can pre-order that now. You can do that through your local bookstore. You can do it through bookshop.org, such as bookshop.org for a little bookshop that you may know something about called Goldberry Books, or, you know, you can buy it through other sorts.
More mundane means.
Thank you. That's the nicer way of saying the behemoths, which is a very gothic way of putting it, I suppose. Mm-hmm. So anyway, thank you so much to B&H Publishing for helping sponsor the show. And thank you to Karen Swallow Pryor for delivering to the world these beautiful editions. They look good on a shelf and they read really well. So check those out. Okay, let's talk about Rebecca. Mm-hmm. Although we also should talk a little bit about our unnamed narrator, because I have lots of questions about her. I have many questions about her. I'm concerned about her. I've got to say, I feel like she might have some problems. First, I want to ask a question, which is super pedantic and annoying. What is this book about? And you know that I don't mean, like, can you just recycle the plot of the first 14 chapters of the book? But what is this book actually about? Heidi, what do you think? What's your, like,
coming of age?
A building's roman type thing?
It's a self-actualization novel. It's about our unnamed narrator becoming a woman, moving from child to woman through marriage, which is a little weird, but normal, I guess, at that time.
Well, I mean, if you get married at this point in your life, isn't that just the way it is?
Yes. That's
regardless
what I
of
think
era?
This novel is about.
That's interesting. Okay. Tim, is that what you were?
Yeah, that makes sense to me. I don't know that I would have come up with that, but having heard it, I'm going to adopt it as my answer because I don't think I can improve on it.
So
thanks, why do you ask, David? Thanks for agreeing with me. Why do you ask, David?
What if you weren't going to agree with her? What would you say?
Well, I would say,
well,
I mean,
now
okay.
He can't not agree with me. So,
right. You're
kidding.
Right.
Yeah. Yes, you can. You absolutely could.
What if it's a horror story? Or something along those lines. Not a horror story,
it's not a Stephen King
Scream
novel.
Movies yeah. or something like that. Yeah, like a Stephen King novel. But it is maybe a suspense novel is what it is. That's better than a horror story. Horror story, there's got to be viscera and bones and bloodlettings. But
that all
just
happened off
a
stage.
Great suspense story.
What's being suspended.
What is going on at Manderley is what's being suspended. Like, it's just so foreboding. Every move that our heroine takes is fraught, and her internal situation mirrors the external suspense. Mm. So, I mean, I'm not really making a case. I agree with Heidi. I think it's a coming of age story.
So
I haven't finished the book yet, but thus far it really fits a coming of age story. It's just so suspenseful. I think it's kind of a marriage of a suspense novel and a building's roman.
Let's talk about this coming of age thing. Cause that's not a way I had thought about it, because to this point, I don't think we have seen her, you find herself. In fact, I read it as the exact opposite. The further we get into the novel, the less she knows herself. So
yeah,
that might not be inconsistent with what you're saying, because, you know, by the end of the novel, maybe she does find herself. But could you explain a little bit more about where you're coming from on that and how you see that playing out? Mm-hmm. In other words, could you defend your highly questionable take?
Claim. Yes. So, full disclosure, I have indeed finished the novel. I read it like immediately after our last recording. Yeah. So I read it actually on the plane while flying to North Carolina to surprise David at a party. So I finished the whole novel that day, which was kind of great. And Tim, you were there. It was really fun.
I was there.
Small party, yeah. Just to be clear. Mostly family.
It wasn't like a party that people weren't invited to that might be listening. So...
Yeah, that's definitely what I meant when I said small. Yeah.
Yes.
Go on.
You just, yeah. Okay, so there's so much attention paid in this section that we just read of her inner life and her assumptions and everything she's thinking, feeling her awkwardness about her marriage, about the house, about this new social status that she's inhabiting and doesn't know how to do it, which would be awkward for anybody. But this particular girl is young and callow and very, very self-absorbed. And so I think that we have in this section one of the problems of novel, a deeper problem in the novel. There's other problems in the novel to be overcome. For example, what the heck's going on with Max? What about Rebecca? All these other things that take place in kind of the story proper, the gothic part of the story. Underneath all of that is this question of what is this girl going to do about any of it? And everything that we've seen so far says that she's going to be passive and awkward and do nothing. And so as we see that part of her develop, that is why I'm saying this is a coming of age story.
So go ahead, Tim. Tim, you were going to say
something. She, in the first part of the book, which we read, which we discussed last week, she has this person who's opposing her. Is it Van Hopper? Did I already forget her name?
Yeah.
And it seems like in the second part of the book, we have another female opposition, Mrs. Danvers. And they're set up, like, who's going to be the boss of the house? Like, it's Maxim because he owns it.
Right.
But
not really.
But not really. It's going to be one of these two women.
Well, and last week we talked about how we were trying to figure out who the bad guy is. And so it's interesting that you say that these two people that are almost in opposition to her.
And she finds it so difficult as our heroine to stand against, to just assert her own preferences to Mrs. Danvers. So page 74. The heroine says, "Mrs. Danvers," I heard myself saying, "I hope we shall be friends and come to understand one another. You must have patience with me, you know, because this sort of life is new to me. I've lived rather differently, and I do want to make a success of it, and above all, to make Mr. De Winter happy. I know I can leave all the household arrangements to you. Mr. De Winter said so, and you must just run things as they have always been. I shan't want to make any changes." So, and by doing that, our heroine is just kind of, in a way, she's defaulting to Mrs. Danvers, the housekeeper, but she's also saying, hey, the former mistress of the house, Rebecca, let's just keep doing things the same way that they've been done. So in a way, I think it's kind of interesting that she's bowing to Mrs. Danvers, and in doing so, she's also bowing to the memory of Rebecca.
Go ahead, Heidi.
Yeah, I think that he's exactly right. Like, there's, in enabling Mrs. Danvers to run this house this way, she is attempting to ingratiate herself to her, because she truly doesn't know what she's doing right now. But instead, it just keeps Rebecca then kind of at this unspoken tyrant that's running everything, even in her absence. And I think that our narrator dimly is beginning to understand that, and particularly in the last chapter. There's this, you know, her fraught conversation with Mrs. Danvers. But at the beginning, she's just trying, I mean, she's essentially trying to make herself invisible. She's unnamed and invisible.
Who is the narrator?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the question I have, though, is whether the narrator is actually crazy.
Oh, really?
Go on.
I don't believe anything that she says.
Really?
No, I haven't finished the book.
Yeah.
Because I'm like purposefully kind of pacing it as we go, because I'm kind of interested in what that experience is going to be like for doing the podcast. But, you know, a little experiment on my own capacity to do that, to do this while not knowing the end of the story. When I read her, it seems to me like the story is constantly... The only person we can believe that things are as sinister as they seem is our narrator. And she hasn't necessarily, to me, proven herself to be trustworthy yet. Like, for example, is Mrs. Danvers actually as sinister as she seems? Does the narrator actually have as many reasons to be bothered by the people who visit? Is she seeing the world as it actually is? Is she actually, does she have a realistic view of her marriage and the way she doesn't even tell herself the truth. So why should we believe that she tells us the truth? You know, for example, there's a conversation with Max where they're talking about their marriage, and he's like, she's like, no, we're definitely happy. I promise. And he's like, okay, if you say so, I think it's a failure. And she's like, begging him to believe that it's true, but she even says there that she was basically just telling herself that in the moment to make herself feel better. to make herself feel like she made the right decision. So if she's not even telling the other characters the truth, then why should we believe that what she says about people like Mrs. Danvers is the truth?
Right.
The book is made, it feels sinister because she tells us she felt that it was sinister. But how much of that is in her head, and how much of that then is controlling our perspective and our sense that it's actually sinister?
David, do you think that she's lying with intention to us?
Is no, that the way that she's untrustworthy?
and so because she's not found herself, she's unable to report what's happening external to herself because, like, what's the saying? She can't get out of her own way.
I think she can't get out of her own head.
Yeah.
So she sees she's seeing the world in a very specific way. And whether it's inexperience, immaturity, youth, whatever you want to put it, or those things, or the fact that she's just crazy, or some combination of her own anxieties. Like, on the one hand, it's immaturity. On the other hand, it's craziness. Most likely, it's something like anxiety combined with immaturity. But, you know, obviously, everybody who's listening who's read the book, including you, Heidi, is like just shaking their head.
I think you're right. I think you're completely right in everything that you said. And I'm glad you asked what you did, Tim, about whether or not our narrator is lying, which would be kind of an interesting twist if you're, there's a couple of different ways you could go with this novelist at this point, if you're the author, right? But I think that you've hit the nail on the head about this woman, this young woman's perceptions. Everything that we're getting is perception here, and actually nothing sinister even happens until chapter 14, when Mrs. Danvers goes a little bit crazy in Rebecca's old bedroom. And that is, I think, the first clue at all that we have that something's actually wrong in this house. Everything else could be explained by this narrator overreacting in a very adolescent mind.
Go ahead, Tim.
Do you agree with that, Tim, or no?
Well, the only other thing, again, I've not finished the book, but the only other thing that kind of sparked my concerns about something going wrong was the meeting with this strange,
mentally impaired
young man down on the beach. That was spooky. That was really spooky.
But it could have just been spooky because the way she sees the scene.
Yeah. I'm going to stick with it. Absolutely. Absolutely. Could just be the way that she sees the scene. I think there's something because of Maxim's response when she comes back. I'm taking it that it's more than her worry is more than just in her head. I think that Maxim doesn't want her interacting with this guy very much.
Yeah, I think one of the smart things about this novel, one of the genius elements of this novel, is the way it holds a sort of tension in terms of Maxim's response to everything that is going on around him. Because on the one hand, it makes sense that a grieving husband who then brings in this new bride and she's young and, you know, trying to fit in, he would distance himself from the things that he's been through in the past, and he would be secretive about it just out of grief and trying to create a new life. So on the one hand, that makes sense. On the other hand, yeah, maybe he has something to hide and she's trying to discover bit by bit how to respond to his weirdness. So on the one hand, it makes sense that he's being weird. Like, you could come up with any number of reasons for why he responds to the way he does. And so that's one of the great things about what Daphne du Maurier does here. On the other hand, you could also just read it like he's a creepy dude. Whether he's actually creepy or not is what I think is where the real tension of the story lies. The house is part of it. And the Rebecca factor hovering over everything like a sort of all-seeing ghost is there. That's obviously there. But that's the sort of staple of an old house drama, right? The real question for me, the real question of what's sinister is how much is ultimately, the book hasn't really come out and said this, but you can tell it's like, how much is Maxim responsible for what happened to Rebecca and all that? So...
It's interesting, David, because I am not taking the threat of her misreporting as a primary source of tension. Like, I'm just kind of believing all of the tension, that it's somehow real. And I totally grant that it can be kind of conjured. But I think that it's a young woman who's responding to real external threats or some real external mystery or discomfort in the house. Like, I take that to be real.
Yes, I agree with that.
Okay.
I think it's a matter of degree.
Yeah, maybe it's a matter of degree. Maybe you're like in the red. The needle is in the red. You're like, man, I just don't know if like she's just like really overreactive. And I'm maybe a little bit more in the middle. Like, yeah, she's reacting strongly, but it's not, the needle's not in the red for me. Do you think that's a fair?
Yeah, maybe. I think maybe it kind of hovers around the word sinister. Like, there's something. It makes sense that things would be a little bit weird in this house. First of all, the kind of house it is. Second of all, what has happened recently?
What's happened?
The lord of the house. Third, there's the fact that she's just been thrown in there and doesn't really belong there. So it would also feel weird to her as the newbie, so to speak, who doesn't have experience in that sort of a setting. So all those things make sense that it would feel weird.
Yeah.
But to what extent, for example, is Mrs. Danvers a sinister figure? And everything every time she describes her as this like skeletal type figure. Even when they go up the drive and the way she sees what we talked about last week, what she sees with the, you know, the threatening trees and all that, someone else sees it and it doesn't see it as threatening at all. Remember the guy that comes to visit and they're talking about it, he sees all the grounds and the trees and everybody else, even Max sees them as beautiful, but she sees them as threatening. So is it that it's weird and uncomfortable what's happening there? Or is it that something sinister is happening there?
Mm-hmm.
She seems to be coming to the conclusion that there is something sinister going on. But do we just, it seems like you just accept, and I don't mean that as like critical. Accept that.
Dude, you're so naive. Yeah. You think this is like a terrifying story. You think this is just suspenseful. You're so naive. No, I totally get what you're saying. Yeah, I do think that I think that she's responding to something that's genuinely sinister.
So Heidi, you can jump in at any time. I think one thing that's impacting my reading of this is that I thought it was a different kind of book. I didn't expect a Jane Eyre style Gothic novel. Mm. I expected more of a literary British mystery novel. And I'm not talking
like Cloak Sayers and Dagger.
I'm not talking like Sayers or Agatha Christie or something like that, but like a psychological mystery novel more than like a, where there's actually something they're trying to solve, more than like a Gothic Jane Eyre novel where the girl's trying to find herself. So what I was expecting it to be is different than what it was or is. Mm-hmm. So that might be also coloring my view, which is, you know, both the kind of neither here nor there. I was going to make a judgment about myself on that, but
it's funny because I feel like if I had not finished the novel, I'd have a lot more to say right now.
I know, Heidi. I know. I keep looking at you and
you ruined the podcast.
I don't want to know what Heidi is
thinking.
Heidi
ruins the podcast.
And I think even
whatever it is.
the time that Heidi ruins the podcast.
The wheels have come off. I always knew this would happen. Now I'm going to go obsessively into my head to figure out how I have failed. And I'll be just like our unnamed narrator. So,
yeah, we're no longer going to call you by a name.
That's right.
Yes.
She
who is on Zoom with us.
That's right. You must not
the
be
other
named.
One.
I interrupted you, Heidi. Sorry.
So, yeah, I feel like if I had not finished it, I would have a lot more to say right now, because at this point of the novel, I had made a lot of assumptions about the novel. And then, now that I have finished it, I feel like anything I say would be colored by the fact that I finished the end of this novel. So which has not ever happened on the podcast before, I find that interesting. This is a very plot-driven novel, actually. By this, even though it feels so character-driven right now, once the plot is resolved, it colors everything about interpreting this section that we read.
Oh, really? Really?
Because this section that we just read is so internal. This is this girl describing her very awkward first days as the mistress of this manor, and she has literally no help at all.
So should we just end the podcast now and go read and then come back next week?
She, you know, this was when I was reading this part that I was like, this is what I would do if I was you, girlfriend. Why don't you sit down with your husband and you say, I do not know what in the heck I am doing. What do I do from 7 a.m. to 10 a.m. as a mistress of a house like this, right? Like, what do I do after that? What do I do after lunch? Like, tell me what to do. That's what a woman would do, right? Mm-hmm. Not a girl child bride, not a child bride. And this is why I'm saying this is a coming of age story, because this is a young woman who has no idea what she's doing, no idea how to advocate for herself, no idea how to distinguish the perceptions in her own mind and connect them to what is actually happening out here. And I think that is the problem of the novel, because all of these sinister things that are happening, they do have an explanation, right? So, but she can't figure out how to get there. And so she's in many ways her own antagonist right now. And this is one of those novels that's much easier to talk about after you've read it, you know, like at the end. Now I'm like, oh, I want to say, I think that this is because of this. And this over here is because of this, because this novelist, Daphne du Maurier, really is building up to something. We have all of these little clues. We have a lot of clues in this section. But as David's pointing out, our narrator's perceptions are so self-oriented. She's like gaslighting herself this entire time.
Someone said that on the Facebook page. Someone said, I've never read a book where the main character is gaslighting herself.
Right.
And you said the same thing. Okay.
So it's actually kind of hard to talk about it, because I want to start pointing out all the things that matter, but that's just cheating.
Right.
So I was reading in the New York Review of Books this week, there is an amazing new profile of Kaze Shiguro, who has a new novel coming out on next Tuesday.
Oh.
It's called Clara.
I read that.
Clara and the Sun. You read the profile?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So it's by Giles Harvey, and it was published on the 23rd. And there's a paragraph in it that smacked me in the face and made me think of this book. And it's a great profile, and his new book is really, I've been reading some of it. It's really good. One of my favorite writers, though. So, you know, it's like he could describe the, you know, a pear tree growing and a little boy climbing into it and taking a nap. And I'd be like, this book is so good. actually, that probably could be good. But so this profile says this. It is not for nothing that Ishiguro has named Charlotte Bronte as the novelist who influenced him most. And then this bit. From Jane Eyre, he learned how to write first-person narrators who hide their feelings from themselves but are transparent to other people.
Interesting.
Rereading the book a few years ago, he kept coming across episodes and thinking, oh my goodness, I just ripped that off. And then it goes on. But that line there was like one of those ones that I wrote down. He learned how to write first-person narrators who hide their feelings from themselves but are transparent to other people. Because this is a really complex notion in fiction, because there's first of all, that's just a fascinating concept. I think it applies to this book, but there's three different elements to this that make it complicated. Because on the one hand, you've got the character who is the narrator, who is in the moment, right? Who the narrator is presenting as experiencing a scene or a moment with a limited view of the world. And doesn't know themselves. Then you've got the third character, the other characters, who everybody else looks at them and knows exactly who they are, which we have in this book. And then you have the third element is you have the narrator at the time when they're telling the story, who looks back and may or may not know themselves as the character that was in the book. So on the one hand, we might have an older and wiser character who has finally found herself, looking back at her youthful self and creating the story. Or we might also have an older narrator who's not wiser and still doesn't know herself and is telling the story about herself. And then we've got us.
Right.
And how do we interact with the pieces, the bits of information that are being given to us? And this is, it's like a really complex, I guess that's a square because there's four parts, but it's like a cube of complexity in terms of how you craft that narrative. Because in that box is all this information that's getting shaken up. And if you're on a different corner, you experience it in a different corner in the cube. Just bear with me on this metaphor. Then you experience that information in a different way. And so the question for me is, if you look at that line in the profile, who hides her feelings from herself but are transparent to other people, do you agree that that applies here? So on the one hand, is this a character who is hiding her feelings from herself, and does everyone else see her for who she is?
Yes, I think that that's completely true. With one exception in the novel. But
what do you mean there's one character who doesn't see her first?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And I think, and I keep saying this, I think that is the problem that the novel is going to take on. Not what happened to Rebecca, right? Like, all these other things are the backdrop for that, for the development and the resolution of child bride to competent, empowered woman. Yeah. And yes. And I think that that's where we get kind of this underlying contemplation of feminism, of womanhood, of what it means, mm-hmm. and what it takes to turn a child into a woman. I think that's a very big deal in this novel.
Mm. Can I ask you a question related to this that I was thinking about? I was listening to the audiobook last night while I was driving somewhere, and this question got stuck in my head. Rebecca, everybody had previously turned to Rebecca to run the house, right? But then it's also pretty clear that Max and Danvers and the butler and all, they all played this very significant role even when Rebecca was there. So for our narrator, what does she view as being lady of the house? Like, what is that person supposed to do in her mind through this point in the novel? Because she feels very not capable of it. Mm-hmm. But is that because she has the wrong view of what her role is actually supposed to be? And that the person whose shadow she is in, Rebecca, her understanding of it would have been different. And in that way, our narrator could learn to be like that. Did that make any sense what I just asked?
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's a good question. And I think to your point that you just made about writing.
Tim, characters, I think she's just going to say you have to wait till the end.
Maybe so.
Who knows? That is such an insufferable thing to say, though, right? Like, I can't bring myself to say anything like that. But
it's like when you're in an argument with someone and you say, have you read the latest New York Times editorial? Oh, okay. Oh, you haven't read it yet? Oh, exactly. Okay. Which is like kind of like just saying, well, then I won because I read the article. Right. You know, and really the person's just
I'm more educated than you.
Yeah, that's kind of,
so that's annoying single. When people say that. So please forgive me if I'm being insufferable. But I think
I feel like you're being very careful to like let us still enjoy the suspense
you're
of the
being
book.
Very
I really
sufferable.
Appreciate it. I'm being very sufferable.
Thank you, Phew. To the point, David, that you made, that quote about being able to write characters who essentially don't know themselves, but other people see them, right?
Yeah, for who then, they are, yeah.
Yes. For who they are. That is the problem with her inability to become the mistress of this home, because it actually is really, really hard. And it is that's one of those things that young women are brought up to do. And it's clear that Rebecca has always been in this high social class.
Right.
So she grew up in a home very much like this. And so she knew how to ride and how to hunt and how to run a household and how to order a menu and how to hire servants and what is her job and what's the housekeeper's job. I mean, it's just such a subtle, it's a life. It's like a completely different culture. And yes, like so hard. So I think the problem with our unnamed narrator is that she's so insecure and so unable to know herself that she assumes that she's not doing a good job because she's such a failure, right? Because she can't do it, because Rebecca is better than her. Instead of saying, like, I actually just don't know how to do this and I need help.
Yeah. Because if she just acted like a normal human being and didn't hide behind doors and stuff broken things into, like if she stopped acting like my 9-year-old, right, things would be less weird.
Yeah.
Like they would just respect her more.
Right. Or she could ask, like she could ask Maxim, she could talk to Maxim's sister. Hey, I didn't grow up. I grew up in this kind of home. And yet here we are. Can you make me a list of the things I need to do? Can you stay here for a day and show me, you know, all those are the kinds of things that you and I would do. I mean, you would never be a young child bride, but these are the kinds of things that an adult human being does. So, but she's not, she's a child and she thinks like a child and she's painfully shy and all these things. And I have like so much compassion for this sweet young woman who just kind of needs someone my age to come and take her under her wing and tell her how to be a grown up, right? And she doesn't have that. And instead of just saying, that's because I literally don't have the skills to do it. And so I just need to learn. She blames herself. And that's what I mean about like this gaslighting of herself. That's a small example of it. That's probably the biggest example that we have of it in this section with the housekeeping is this is, she doesn't know how to be a lady and she's so insecure and she's convinced herself that's because she's a failure instead of just, I don't know how to do it and I need help.
You know, it's really interesting. Just a little bit of sociological input here. I read in a Malcolm Gladwell book one time about this series of psychological, like a psychological survey that was performed among kind of like families that they deemed successful and families they deemed unsuccessful. And I think the main difference was like psychological health, financial well-being, sorts of things like this. Things that I think like most people would probably agree about. And they followed families around, families from successful families and unsuccessful families, and they just tried to discern what the difference in the parenting was. And of course, there's huge variety among successful parents, and there's huge variety among unsuccessful parents. But the thing that the researchers discovered was that the thing that successful parents did more than anything else was they taught their kids to assert themselves like toward authorities. So there's this little story that Gladwell tells in one of his books about a researcher's riding the car with the mother and the son, and the mother is taking the son, like 10 years old, to the doctor's office. Before they get to the doctor's office, the mother says to the son, now, this is just a checkup. Tell me how you're feeling. What do you want the doctor to know? And the son, you know, says, my, you know, foot has been bothering me a little bit. Now they get to the doctor's office and the doctor does the checkup and he gets to the end and he says, you know, so have you been feeling okay? The son says, yeah, I've been feeling fine. The mother says, Johnny, but what did you tell me in the car? And then Johnny says, he doesn't really want to say. And the mother says, Johnny, tell the doctor what you told me in the car because that's what we're here for. So Johnny then had to kind of like assert himself to this authority figure, this doctor. He said, my foot's been bothering me. Okay. So now the doctor tends to the foot and, you know, you go forward. And so I thought of that when I'm reading this book. Rebecca has no parents that we know of in her life. The maternal figure
about
that she,
our unnamed
I'm
narrator
sorry, not Rebecca, yeah. not Rebecca, our unnamed narrator has no parents in her life. The maternal figure that she does have in her life is just like kind of a squabbling, you know, tyrant of a small kingdom, Mrs. Van Hopper, Hooper. Why am I screwing her name up already? And so it's now Hopper. Our heroine is thrust into this house where she's got no guidance. And there's this new, I'm really playing the new maternal figure of Mrs. Danvers, who's actually kind of like suppressing her in a way. And it leads to this, I find myself as the reader in this state of frustration, like you were expressing, Heidi, like she needs someone to teach her how to assert herself. She's got to have it or she's going to be stymied and it's going to go nowhere good for her. And it creates a real tension where I lean forward and every new encounter with Mrs. Danvers or even with Maximum or some of the neighbors that come in, I keep waiting for her to step up and say, get out of my house, you know, or like, we're having meatloaf for dinner tonight. That's what we're having because I like meatloaf. And it just doesn't happen, you know? So it creates this strength, like this tension in the reader that you want self-assertion. And so it makes me think, I'm going to look away from you, Heidi. I'm not going to take any clues from your face. You're a wall.
That's right.
I think part of the victory of the book, if there is going to be a victory, must come from our heroine asserting herself in some way. And maybe it's leaving maybe it's taking command of the house, though I doubt that's going to happen because we knew from page one, she's no longer at the estate. So, but I think that she's got to assert herself. Okay. Also, I had an idea, David. I had an idea that maybe we could, at this point in the book, put forward what we think is going to happen in the book, because I think it could be pretty funny when we look back and
by all means, do that.
You got to join me with it. You got to come along for the ride. You have to assert your bogus harebrained scheme about what's going to happen in this book. But you've seen the movie. You kind of know.
But I will say, I think the movie's, I've heard the movie's different as ending, and I haven't seen it in a very long time.
But you remember the movie, you remember the ending well enough to say,
no, I don't. Maybe you should. I don't really honestly remember. And that, like, the Hitchcock movie, they changed the ending, is my understanding.
Huh. Okay. So, I'm going to do it.
Go.
So that everyone can kind of giggle at me. Question before we do that, though, have we met the character? Hold on, I'm looking up his name. Jack Favell yet? Have we met him in this reading?
Yes, he is. Yes.
Okay. I am now safe to like put forward my theory. Mm-hmm. Here, my theory is, oh gosh, it's going to be so bad when I find out how wrong I am.
Is Rebecca.
No, I think that Rebecca had a dark side. I think that she had something with Jack Favell. I think that Jack Favell shows up at the house to kind of flirt with Mrs. Danvers, because Mrs. Danvers has this kind of like strange affinity for Rebecca. Like she's like just, you know, she wants to be her. She at least kind of like, you know, wishes that she was still alive. So I think this Jack Favell character, who's really dark and kind of sinister, he's an alcoholic, he's just trouble. I think that he and Rebecca had an illegitimate child together who's living down by the beach. Maxim feels obligated to take care of him, right? They're related. Jack Favell and Rebecca are related, so it could in some way contribute to the young man's mental defect. And I think that Rebecca, when discovered that Jack Favell was the father of her child, sailed out into the ocean and like entered her life. Is that the craziest thing you've ever heard? Heidi, you're being so good. You are like stone faced.
I'm like,
David, you're being stone faced too. Okay. I'm just going to put that out there. And now we can lock it away. And we can come back at the end of the episodes and say, Tim, remember your illegitimate child theory?
I think every book is made better by an illegitimate child. You know what I mean? So that's not true. I don't think that. Like Goodnight Moon, not made better by an illegitimate child. I take it back.
I'm trying to think through the scenarios that would be involved.
Yeah.
I think that there's definitely something. I think maybe Rebecca's reputation is going to have to be.
It's got to be questioned. Knocked down in a peg. It's got to be.
I think part of me, there's going to be questions of who or how she died, who you know, impacted, led, who took actions that led to her demise. I mean, part of me wants it to be like a Shirley Jackson. There's a ghost in the walls story. You guys have read Haunting of Hill House, right?
Mm-hmm. No.
Haunting of Hill House is a great book.
Is it really?
Really.
A close reads quality book?
It's a ghost story. It's pretty creepy, but it's, ooh. I would say it's that. Yeah, it's probably that level. I mean, cheap.
Okay.
Yeah. I can't get my head away from like the idea that this is like a British like mystery novel more than a gothic novel. So I'm trying to think of how would she subvert the whole gothic mystery or had the whole gothic novel genre? And then also, I don't want to just predict that it's going to be the same thing as Jane Eyre. Like, is there going to be a fire at some point?
There's, right.
You know, real question though, can you have a gothic novel if it doesn't involve a fire?
I've never heard of one.
A fire within the main residence.
Yeah, right, right.
Is Wuthering Heights a fire in the main residence?
Just the fire of Heathcliff's psychopathology.
Okay, I need to say something about my theory.
That.
I feel like after having spoken my theory, the two of you are now treating me as if I've like committed some terrible party foul.
I'm thinking through what elements of your it make sense.
Okay. Because I think like we should just move on. I
want to
told an off-color joke. Because here's,
we actually have a couple of real clues in the story.
Yeah, there's some foreshadowing.
Like, yes. For example, when on the beach and she finds the cottage and Ben is there.
Yes.
And she's having a conversation with Ben. He tells her in this section, you have nice eyes. And then he goes on to say, not like the other one. She gave me a feeling like a snake.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's right.
He has clearly been rejected.
We do have some clues up to this point, especially that phrase, the other one.
Mm-hmm. Right? Yeah.
So we have, and I say that, and then we have Favelle, and then we have Mrs. Danvers' very strange obsession with Rebecca's space.
So weird.
So we have clues that are moving towards that. This is to David's and both of your points. We have over here a series of clues that if we had a narrator who is paying attention to something other than her own insecurities, she could begin to catch on. But this is to David's point that what we have are a whole bunch of perceptions and conclusions that our narrator comes to without noticing these other things that our really smart novelist has embedded within the story.
There makes a
dissonance between the perception and the reality, which we have to resolve at some point.
Yeah.
Which has the effect of not making it clear to us what the mystery actually is.
Exactly.
We have a vibe so far, but we don't have a definition. Mm-hmm. Like there's the vibe of mystery, right? There's the sort of mood and tone.
Which, to your point,
David,
to your point about the mystery novel versus the gothic novel, gothic novels are so atmospheric.
Atmosphere is a better word than vibe.
So we have this like heavy atmosphere in this novel, but a mystery novel has like a clear problem to solve, right? We've got like a body or a missing jewel or something like that. And here we just have kind of this very young adolescent narrator trying to adapt to her life. And meanwhile, these sinister things are going on. And if you're close reading and paying attention, you're catching these little things like, mm-hmm. if Rebecca is so perfect, why does she give you a feeling like a snake? Right?
Right.
But our narrator doesn't catch any of that because she's so busy thinking about how she can't measure up. So this is the dissonance that at this point in the novel, you could come to it and be like, I don't even know what's going on in this story, but there is something going on and her perceptions are part of the problem.
Mm. It's the same thing with the conversation that she has with Max about their marriage. Cause she's just trying to convince him. She just spends the whole time trying to convince him that they're happy. Instead of saying, whoa, he doesn't think we're happy. Mm-hmm. That's actually a problem. And it's not going to, I can't solve it by just telling him we're happy. Like, what does that actually mean? She doesn't stop and smell the roses, so to speak.
Right. Because in her mind, she thinks the problem is that she's not as good as Rebecca.
Right.
I can't measure up. Right. Yeah.
She thinks she can make him happy. And the reason that he's not happy is because of her.
So it doesn't seem to occur to her. Like, hey, do you have any problems?
So is
like,
that?
It seems
is
like
that,
a really valid question to ask her husband, who's acting weird. But she blames herself. It's me. Mm-hmm, I haven't been doing enough. I'm not like Rebecca. I'm not good enough. I'm failing. Instead of another natural assumption might be, hey, is there something wrong with you that I need to know?
Yeah.
Is this? You talk about it being a coming of age novel. Is this a sign of immaturity? Like, are these signs of? Is this how people are when they're immature? I mean, I know that self-absorption is to some degree, and it varies from person to person. Or is it a sign of something I use the word again, deeper, more sinister within herself. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean evil. I just mean like she is afflicted by something more complex than immaturity. Mm-hmm. And I know that you can't necessarily answer that.
No, but I think I can affirm that as like the right question to ask, right? Like, I think that that's where we're at in the novel is there. This is not, if this was a more self-assured young woman, she might say something is going on here that isn't right. I can feel it and I deserve an explanation for it, right? But instead we have a narrator who's like, this is because I'm not as good as Rebecca. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So she's asking all the wrong questions and coming to all the wrong conclusions. And we meanwhile have no idea what, to your point, David, what we can believe that she's claiming. So there's a dissonance between our narrator and the reader. And that is, I think, brilliant writing on Daphne du Maurier's part. Like, I think she succeeds really brilliantly in creating this gap that you just have to keep going to figure out what's going on, right?
I think part of the reason I love this book is because it really appeals to a form that I think is really compelling as dramatic narrative. Crime and Punishment is this way. Our main character does not know himself. I mean, does not know himself and is acting in a way that he's causing harm to others, of course, and he's also causing harm to himself. And the process of the book, the flowering of the book, is him finally coming to understand himself. And in a way, he can only understand himself through the kind of the anthropology of the gospel. Oh, this is who I am. This is what I have done. You know, and I find that a profoundly difficult task to take on as a writer. And I think that Daphne du Maurier is trying to do something similar with a very different character, not with a murderous character like Raskolnikov, but with almost the opposite of an Übermensch. You've got like the wilting dayflower who cannot grow, who cannot step forward, who cannot stand up straight, who can't say no or yes when anybody kind of pushes against her. Raskolnikov is the exact opposite. He wants to be the person who says, my will be done, you know? And our heroine seems to me, she's the exact opposite. But in both situations, the central problem is the problem of the self. They don't know themselves and are so hampered from redemption, joy, well-being, because they don't know themselves.
I love that. I love everything you just said. The central problem is the self. Yes.
This is the big issue for me. This is the big issue in life. It's like, it's not a politics problem. It's not an economic problem. It, you know, it's not a familial problem. All those things are really important. But like the problem of the self, of figuring out who I am and what my problem is, that seems to me like the whole task of life. And if being you do human. Discover it, yeah, being yeah. human. And
the
if
world
you do,
is peopled by people who don't have self-knowledge.
Yes. And I think part of the reason that Socrates is like admonition to know thyself is stuck with us for so long is not because it's pithy, but because it's true.
Exactly.
It just also happens to be pithy.
It happens also to be pithy.
So can you think of a single great novel, like truly great novel, where you had a character who like your protagonist actually knew themselves?
Mm.
Throughout the whole novel?
Well, I mean, yeah, that's not the central point of the novel, I guess, or right. one of or the not or really. One of the defining.
I don't think I can.
Pride and Prejudice. I think nope. That, Huckleberry Finn.
Yep.
Nope. Mm-hmm. Brideshead Revisited. Nope.
That's why the everything resolution. By, but that's
every Russian
why.
Thing anybody ever wrote.
It's right. It's all the self, and that's why
Hamlet.
The resolution, the changing moment of every novel is repentance. Right? It's some kind of, a realization of the self that then changes the course of the novel, right? It's metanoia that I don't know, like I repent. That's what happens to Elizabeth Bennet. That's what you used Pride and Prejudice as your first example, right? Like that is it is an issue of her repentance that brings resolution to this novel. And that, I think, is because, as Tim's pointing out, the central problem of every story, our own included, is the problem of our the need to return to the good.
And sometimes you get characters like in Pride and Prejudice who think they do know themselves and have the answers, and they're self-knowledge
always wrong.
And then you've got, and sometimes you've got characters like this where the characters don't know themselves or don't think that they are capable or whatever. And sometimes the book is just about a character, like their own self-awareness about their lack of self-knowledge is not really part of the story, but you know, but still the discovery of self-knowledge is part of the story, even if it's not like
Eddie and I've just finished
R2
or Richard II on The Play's the Thing. And we spent a lot of time in Act 2, Scene 3, which is this famous speech, let us sit upon the ground and tell sad stories of the death of kings. And it's a story, it's the monologue is from Richard II kind of discovering that he's not merely a king, but he's a man. And it kind of, it culminates, for you have mistook me all this while. I live with bread like you, feel want, taste grief, need friends. Subjected thus, how can you say to me, I am a king? It's this wonderful moment of self-discovery that changes him. It changes the play in a lot of ways. And he's been such a pompous, I don't know what the right word, he's been so pompous and out of touch with who he is up until that point. And it feels like such a relief when he comes to see himself. Again, we're talking about self-knowledge, but in this book, Rebecca, the self-knowledge, I wonder if I can say this. It seems like when the kind of masculine tendency is towards self-knowledge of it, toward an over-evaluation. And I wonder for this young woman, it's self-knowledge caused by like an under-esteem. She kind of devalues herself. And I even wonder if that, I don't want to make too much out of that, but because I know, you know, plenty of men that have struggled with a lack of self-esteem and plenty of women who think far too highly of themselves. But the juxtaposition between Richard II thinking far too much of himself and our heroine in Rebecca thinking far too little of herself, both have a problem of a lack of self-knowledge.
The problem for us as readers, though, is that like when I read about her, this narrator's takes on it, on everything, I wish she would ask, but I also don't think she's wrong. Like,
ooh, what do you mean?
There are plenty of things that she thinks she's not capable of yet, or she's not good at, or that whatever, that she doesn't live up to Rebecca, that she just doesn't live up to Rebecca, to Heidi's point earlier, right? Like, she's not really, she hasn't been bred, for lack of a better term, to be the lady of this house. She hasn't been prepared for that. And so she is not wrong to feel like she doesn't live up to what the tradition of those kind of places would ask her to be. So she does have a degree of self-awareness in that. The problem is how she responds to that is where the immaturity seems to come in. Like in a sense, you can say the fact that she doesn't think too highly of herself is actually a good thing. She didn't come in there, you know, now maybe it's purely driven by anxiety. And if so, that's probably why the problems come in, right? But there is a degree to which she's not, like, she's being wise and saying, oh no, it's fine. You do the menus. I don't know what I'm doing. Right. Mm-hmm. And there's even like some of the elements, like the way that she thinks about her clothes and being more simple than the average, you know, lady of a large manor would be, like, there's some humility and wisdom there that's actually good. Mm-hmm. The problem is how she then responds to that. And that's why I wonder if, does she look at that in a humble way and that's good, but then she then looks down on herself for that? Is that the problem? Like, it's not actual humility. It's just, what's not pride, but not humility?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think you're bringing up a really good point. And one thing that we haven't discussed that speaks to this point, David, is the fact that Maxim de Winter married her, right? He didn't just go out and find Rebecca Part Two. It's obvious from the beginning that he has chosen a different kind of woman mm-hmm. and brought her into this home. Now, whether he does that from sinister motives or from righteous motives remains to be seen. But that's another question that our narrator isn't asking that could be fruitful to figure out what's going on, right?
Well, and he says to her, he rushed her into it. She's like, no, I really wanted to. And she should have said, like, he's not wrong. He did rush her into it. And he says that to her. Mm-hmm. And she just kind of ignores it. So, because she wants him to be happy. She wants to be able to, you know.
Well, and she married a man older. I mean, there's so many psychological layers to this novel, right? She married a man old enough to be her father, who she is now not asking for help because she doesn't want to fail him. Like, she treats him much more like a father that she's trying to please than a husband that she is equal to, and that they're building a life together. And so there's that. Like, there's, but to both of your points, that's a problem of the self. Right? That's not something that Max can solve for her. He can't come in and give her enough affirmation to help her own the fact that she is a wife, not a daughter. Right? So there's all of these threads to be resolved, and hovering over all of it is Rebecca. Right? Who is Rebecca? Is and can our young narrator ever learn to be a wife in her own right?
So it's a book with daddy issues, is what you're saying.
I think that that's part of it. I think that there is kind of the straightforward gothic plot that we have going on. And then tied into that, there's a very subtle psychological study of each character. I would say Mrs. Danvers' psychological study is less subtle and more in your face. That's real extreme. But the rest of them have like this very kind of, I think, a very round, to use that terminology. Like, she has a lot of these like very round, subtle characters within this novel.
The interesting thing about Danvers, though, and one of the reasons that I doubt our narrator, is because everybody else around her doesn't look at her the same way that the narrator does. Like, the narrator is terrified of her, and Max just keeps saying over and over again, "What is wrong with you? She's just a housekeeper, you know." Mm-hmm. And for the narrator, she's this like larger than life figure that terrifies. That, you know, she's like, she might as well be a, you know, an orc to a hobbit.
Like a monster.
Yeah.
No, it's true. She describes her in like very monstrous terms, like very inhuman, monstrous terms.
And everybody else,
our narrator is acting like a child, right? Mm. She breaks something and she hides it so she doesn't get caught and get in trouble.
She hides behind the door.
Right?
I hear what you guys are saying. I kind of want to defend our heroine a little bit, though. She's in this situation.
Well, we're not attacking her. To your point, you may say whatever you like, but I really need it to be known I'm not attacking her. I'm saying she needs to grow up, not that she's doing anything
agreed.
Wrong.
Yeah. I think that her relationship with Miss Danvers is complicated because of the position that she's in, and that position is shared by nobody else in the novel. So Maxim can like say, why are you so intimidated by Mrs. Danvers? Like, you're the boss, honey. But it's not even true, because Maxim is paying Mrs. Danvers' bills. Mrs. Danvers is probably twice the age of this young woman. All the neighbors that come in who can't understand the conflict between Mrs. Danvers and our heroine, they don't understand it either because they're not in this situation. I mean, I think that the conflict between Mrs. Danvers and our heroine is unique within the book. And thus, it makes... it makes our heroine's situation much more frail than the other character's situation with regards to Mrs. Danvers.
That's true. And one of the reasons that's true is because our unnamed narrator does not know her place in this household, right? And that's one of the things Mrs. Danvers says is, tell me what to do. And that's one thing that's been that both Maxim and Maxim's sister say to her, Mrs. Danvers won't mind at all if you tell her what to do. Mm. Right. Mm-hmm. Because I think this like, what's that other novel we read about the upstairs, downstairs novel?
Remains of the Day.
Yes. When we read Remains of the Day, it was the same kind of thing. Like this, the question of the roles actually does matter in English society. So if you have this middle-class woman who's actually closer to Mrs. Danvers' class than she is to Maxim's class.
Yeah.
Right? And there's nobody there to train her how to be a lady of the house. And so then Mrs. Danvers becomes this like monstrous reminder of her failure all the time. And we've seen in this section that Mrs. Danvers is an antagonist. Like it's not all in this woman's head.
Yeah, yeah.
Mrs. Danvers is absolutely out to get her. And is that whole scene in that bedroom when she makes her touch all of Rebecca's stuff and she asks her if she wants to come in here and lay in the bed and put it on her face. And like, that's crazy. Mrs. Danvers is not a normal person.
When you were reading that, Heidi, were you thinking, Mrs. Danvers, are you kind of like showing us yourself? Is this really what you're all about? Like, this is not a wish for our heroine. This is about you, Mrs. Danvers.
Yeah. Yes, exactly right. Yes. So I don't think that Mrs. Danvers is just like the housekeeper that the lady is that our unnamed narrator is afraid of. Like, she is a sinister figure, but our young wife, our heroine, she still is
matter of degree
responding to her in a very childlike way instead of as a woman.
Mm. Yeah.
We should wrap this up. So let's do some final thoughts. Tim, why don't I let you do a final thought first, and then we'll let Heidi go.
We've talked about well-crafted novels tend to turn in the middle of their narrative. So Richard II being an example, Richard II goes from a lack of knowledge to knowledge about himself in the almost the exact middle of the play. So I'm looking forward into the middle of this book, which is going to be about chapter 18. I'm expecting something's going to happen. And I think it must have something to do with our narrator coming to know herself while learning something about this kind of mystery that she's in. And I'm expecting it, because mine is a 410-page book, I'm expecting it around page 200, which I think is chapter 18. That's what I'm looking forward to. Heidi?
I think this is a more complex novel than it appears right away, because the plot is actually... For me, because I like novels like this, I'm like into the plot. I want to find out who Rebecca is and what happens. Like, I just wanted to get through the novel to find out what happened. But then I found myself haunted by a couple of different things. You know, like once I figured out what happened, you have that like big sigh of relief. Oh, good. Now I can actually read closely.
Stuff. Yeah.
And within a lot of English novels, there's a contemplation of multiple places in a hierarchy of English society. And I think that we have that in this novel. And it's worth thinking about. Mm-hmm. The upstairs, downstairs kind of thing, the servant class versus the upper class. And then you have this character who's trying to figure out how to navigate both of those things and has, you know, feels like she's failing as she's doing it. There's a question of power. Like, I think that the question of power is a very big deal in this novel. Mm-hmm. And then to your point, we have, Tim, you talked earlier about this in the context of herself, but it's also true in kind of a more societal context. Like, she's a young woman, which gives her a lack of power. She's of a lower class than her husband, which gives her a lack of power. Her husband is older than her, which gives her a lack of power. She's got this haunt. She's haunted by the ghost of the ex-wife, which takes away her power, right? So there's there's multiple forces going against our young woman. And at this point in the novel, she is not rising to it. She's not.
Yeah.
So when and if she does, I think we have a contemplation of what to do if you're in that kind of position of a lack of power. Mm. And how that happens in her life, I think, is very interesting and worth contemplating in that context.
Mm. There's a scene... I want to say within the first couple of chapters of the reading that we read for this week, where it's about her not maid, but the person who takes care of her. Because initially her you had the same, the lady's maid, the one who was like,
I would love to have
looking down at her. And yeah, exactly. And then there's, she ends up getting a new one and she goes to visit the girl's mother and the mother's like, oh, she's so happy with you. She feels right at home. And it's, you know, it's very striking that
she's not like a lady at all. That's what she says about her mistress.
It draws that theme you're talking about there right out in a very striking fashion. Okay. Well, so next week we will be on to I forgot to pull up a page.
I've got it, David.
15 through 19. Okay. So we'll read 15 through 19 next week. And then don't forget about the other stuff we've got going on here through Goldberry Studios. We have the Daily Poem, which is back. And then, of course, we've got Tim and Heidi are doing the Plays the Thing through the Cersei Podcast Network, which we're helping produce through Goldberry Studios. So what are you guys doing next? You just did Act 5. So what's on the table for the Plays the Thing?
We would love to get questions from those who have been following along for the Q&A episode. We have also got coming up two very exciting things. Three. I'm going to talk about all three of them. My friend Madeline Wheeler and I did a special one-off episode on the play Cymbeline. Madeline is doing her PhD at the University of Southern California. She's a great classics scholar. And I wanted to bring her on to Cymbeline because there's so many classical allusions. And because it's just like a really, it's a thorny play. It's not Shakespeare's most successful play
for a
reason. It's really peculiar.
So it's just one episode on that play, right?
Exactly. We also are, I'm going to do an interview with a man named James Shapiro, who wrote a book called Shakespeare in a Divided America. And I've read another one of his book, A Year in the Life of Shakespeare. He's a really top-notch Shakespeare scholar. NPR, I think a bunch of major news outlets have done long interviews with him about this book, Shakespeare in a Divided America, and I will be recording an interview with him next week. And of course, Heidi, myself, and Sarah Jane Bentley are going to get together to do Romeo and Juliet, which will culminate with PBS's broadcast of the National Theater's rendering of Romeo and Juliet, which I believe is April 23rd or 24th. Don't quote me. I'll be posting it all over
Shakespeare's birthday.
I thought you were say that it was going to culminate in a sword fight or something.
It's going to culminate in a sword fight.
Yeah, Shakespearean ending. So yeah, check out the Plays the Thing. Make sure you are subscribed to that channel wherever you get podcasts. So lots of great content there. It's going to be a little more consistent. And Tim and Heidi are doing yeoman's work over there. I felt like yeoman's was the right word to use when talking about a play about Shakespeare.
Shakespeare.
And also just when talking about Tim and Heidi.
There's so many yeomans who are into Shakespeare. Yeah.
And apparently yeoman.
Yeah. Then of course we also have our Patreon page, so head over to patreon.com/closereads because we have our Lord of the Rings content. We're well into the Two Towers and we'll have the next episode coming on Tuesday, so in just a few days. Ian and Heidi and I have been having a great time doing that, and we have access to some sweet show swag and also things like the live podcast that we did last week, and we'll do another one of those, you know, before long eventually. We'll figure out a time to do another one of those because we had a great time seeing so many faces and hearing from so many of you. So I guess that's it. Anything else either of you want to add before I sign off? Okay. Well, thank you to BAH Publishing for sponsoring the show this month. And be sure to check out Karen Swallow Pryor's series of books. Again, it's bhpublishing.com/classics. And with that, for Tim McIntosh and for Heidi White, I'm David Kern. Thanks so much for listening. And until next time, happy reading.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.